The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, good afternoon. Sorry, that's loud. My name is Travis Lockyer. I'm the head of grammar school at Annapolis Christian Academy in Corpus Christi, Texas. I have a difficult job of following up that speaker, talk about nuts and bolts of grammar school teaching, but I'll do my best. Please join with me in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we're thankful for your grace and how sufficient it is, how you cover the whole world with the call and duty of Christian cross-field living. We do lift up the believers in China, that you'd watch over them, be with them, grant them the wisdom. We also ask for your wisdom here for me to deliver the words that you ask me to and do all this to your glory. We ask all this in your name. Amen. This talk came about through visiting with Tom Spencer, who is the head of accreditation at ACCS. I was on an accreditation visit with him, and through a series of conversations that he and I had, he said, I have one spot left at the ACCS conference, and I want you to do it. And I said, no. And he said, no, I think this is something that is needed. He gets inundated with all of these upper school humanities teachers that want to talk about philosophy and these big ideas. He's like, but people really want to know kind of boot level, street level teaching, instructional practices. So if you're looking for big ideas and enlightenment and those kind of things, you're in the wrong place. We're going to talk about really practical things. My goal is that you'd walk out of this conference with things that you can use and practically apply in your classroom when school starts again. And maybe they're not exactly the things that I've told you, but they validate things that you're doing. They allow you to tweak and enhance those things for the betterment of you as a teacher and ultimately for the good of the students. First, a little bit about myself. I'm excited that Ben Sass is here because I am a Nebraskan. go Big Red. I have just been in Texas for the last 2 years. Prior to that, I've been in education for over 20 years, all of it in Nebraska. I worked my way up. I was a elementary public school principal and a special ed director. And during that time, I immersed myself in professional development, became fully trained in several instructional models, and fully trained through special education, fully trained as a reading specialist, and really dug in deep with all of those things. The thing that I gravitated towards, which I considered at the time traditional I didn't have the terms of classical, but I see now is more classical in an approach of instructional practice and teaching, and really pushed back against a lot of the new, modern, progressive things that were being thrown at schools, thrown at principals, thrown at teachers. I still remember at the height when Minecraft was really kind of the thing that everyone was into for that brief moment. And a curriculum company made a math curriculum that was based around Minecraft. And kids were to play Minecraft, and the teachers just kind of step to the side and teach mathematic concepts while kids played Minecraft. And I thought, this is just absurd. And my schools traditionally outperformed all other schools that were in our area. And a lot of principals and other schools would come visit, and they would ask, what are you doing? And I had to tell them, like, we're just doing, like, good old-fashioned teaching, and it's working. We are rejecting all of these other things that kept coming and going and cycling through. And I didn't realize that at the time, but God was preparing me for where I'm at now. And so admittedly, I'm still kind of in that phase of unlearning things, but also at the same time redeeming things that I taught and things that I learned and kind of looking at them differently, repurposing them for the glory of God. And Tom Spencer talks about it as the idea of like plundering the Egyptians. There are things that I learned, I was taught, that can be used now in context of classical education that are effective, that'll work and are successful. Let's first talk about, just in general, the classical teaching principles, that these are the broad targets that we're all shooting for. And those of you that are new to teaching or new to classical Christian teaching, these principles are big, they're hard to get your arms around, and even those of you that have been teaching for a number of years know these are a lifelong pursuit to be reaching these. The ones that are the easiest ones to grasp onto, at least particularly at the grammar school level, are the embodied learning and the song, chants, and jingles. You can get your kids up, they can do dramas, they can dress up, they can do the embodied learning. And then I've got my list of songs and chants and jingles, and we can sing this and we can chant that. And those are kind of the low-hanging fruit of what strategies from a classical perspective that we can do. But unfortunately, you've been doing this and it's 10 o'clock in the morning, you've got 18 third graders looking at you and they're kind of like done with the chanting. And now they want, you know, what else do you have? And your toolbox is kind of empty from that perspective, like we're kind of running out of gas here. Little Billy is digging in his desk and he's found a paperclip now that's quite interesting to him. Other kids are looking out the window and looking at a robin building their nest. And you are kind of out of tricks. So typically what I've seen is that teachers will default to lecturing, note-taking, and gobs of worksheets, just to keep things going. Well, there's certainly more to it than that, and I want to talk about some things that to add to the toolbox that you have, or if it's there, validating that, enhancing it, and tweaking it, and really want you to start reflecting in your own practice on things that you can do better, and maybe some things you can add to the toolbox. Let's talk about classical instruction first as a continuum. And this is a gross oversimplification of it. But the mimetic form, which is basically imitation, is foundational to everything that you're doing. And as you move across on the far end, is you have the Socratic student-led discussion. And that's really kind of the goal. You want to prepare kids to be able to handle these Socratic discussions. But it's not an either-or. It's not one is better than the other. And in a lot of ways, you can't skip over one to jump to the other. Like, I want to do Socratic discussion, so I'm just going to jump into that. Well, first of all, if you're a kindergarten teacher, a Socratic discussion on Henry and Mudge is just not going to work. You have to build up to that. And it's not easy to do that because you have to lay the foundation in order to move up, and as you build the house and eventually get to the top, and your Socratic discussion is kind of the icing on the cake as you build through these units and build through the year. And in some ways, you don't really get that payoff until years later when you see them as rhetoric students and being able to hold these wonderful discussions based on the built on the foundation that you created as a grammar school teacher. So we're really talking about beginnings. We're talking about those practical instructional strategies as we are looking at a bigger goal, though. This is more what I'm familiar with. This is the street level kind of language that I'm used to. It's similar in its idea, but I'm not a very bright person, so I like things kind of simple and straightforward. So explicit instruction or all the way the continuum of student-led, discovery-led instruction. The explicit instruction is where kids have little to no background knowledge, that they, because of that, then there's a high level of them failing, and we don't want kids to make a lot of mistakes and learn and practice things incorrectly. So it needs to be very teacher-directed, very explicit in the instruction to set them up for success. Once you've gotten that point, and they have a great deal of background knowledge, then you can do the quote-unquote more fun lessons of the discovery, the student-led backward design lessons. But again, you have to build up to that. And you also have to consider what's developmentally appropriate for them too. So 2 years ago, I'm a public school elementary principal. I have two boys that are in my own system. They're coming home, and I know what's being taught. I know what's going on, and I'm having to tell them, you know, those teachers and some of the things they're saying, they're actually wrong. And I'm trying to deprogram them and realizing I'm losing the battle. And I'm at a crossroads because I'm in charge. This is my school. And I don't even want my two kids going there. So my wife picks up a book, Excused Absence by Douglas Wilson. She's like, you have to read this book. And I read it and was feeling the deep compromise professionally of things I was being asked to do professionally that I was carrying out as part of my job, but personally did not agree with. And this was becoming more and more of a compromising situation for me and also my sons and what the education they were getting and going to be getting. And we just couldn't do it anymore. The next closest school that was just starting up at the time was in Omaha. Is anyone from TCA here in Omaha? Yes, on the way in the back. So they were just starting, and we realized that the classical Christian education that we wanted for our kids, we were going to have to move, I was going to have to change jobs, and I was willing to do all of that. So I started applying for jobs in Omaha, a large urban city in Nebraska. And I was a finalist for one of their large public elementary school principal positions. At a school district that was really high on individualized education plans, that's what they called them. And I'm interviewing at this panel with the superintendent of schools and was trying to do everything I can, like, I just need this job, even though I'm going to hate it, I just need this job because I want my kids to go to this school and to TCA, to this classical Christian school. And I finally got to the point where the superintendent asked me about what I thought about individual education plans. And I just couldn't. Like, I was like, I just have to answer this honestly. I said, students learn best with teachers teaching them explicitly and directly. Having students choose their own projects based on their own preferences with a learning style of their own preference just allows them never to rise above their own ignorance. And that teachers have to be the one leading them forward. And by the look in the superintendent's face, I realized I was not going to get this job. And quite frankly, was very pleased not to, because I believe God had something better, and he did. And we ended up in South Texas, of all places. So let's talk about explicit instruction, or it's synonymous with direct instruction. There's little DI, this little direct instruction, which pretty much any box curriculum set will say, this is a direct instruction program, and typically they're not. So we're talking about capital D, capital I. There's a specific kind of narrow scope when we talk about direct instruction, or I'm using the term explicit instruction to be a little bit more clear on that, with four key components that we're going to talk about, talking mostly about engagement and engaging strategies. The first one is that the explicit instruction needs to be systematic. If you were here on Leaders Day, the executives of Chick-fil-A talked about how they've created a system to create a set of behaviors in their employees. So when you walk into Chick-fil-A, you know what to expect. There's a certain things that you're going to expect, but you create a system in order to get that outcome. The same thing's true with your classroom. You are creating a system to create students or an atmosphere in your classroom to get a certain result. And you as a teacher are in charge of all of those decisions. So you have to decide what's critical and what's not, what are you going to spend time teaching with and what you're not. And the most important part of that is the instructional routines that you use, and we'll talk more about that later. The key thing is this loop that you follow. Model, lead, test, or in more layman's terms, which I like being, is I do it, we do it, now you do it. And that's the cycle that you're going to follow. I do it, imitate me. We do it, guided practice. Now you do it. Show me if you know and understand that. So all of those things have to happen because you, as a teacher, you've prepared those things. You walk into a great teacher's classroom, and to the untrained eyes, it looks like they're pulling rabbits out of their hat and all this magic that's happening in their classrooms over and over again. Like, how do they do that? Year after year, that class is just outstanding and excellent in what they do. Well, the reason why that happens is not because that teacher has these fantastic, you know, once a semester lesson plans or lessons that takes hours of preparation and about 20 minutes to deliver. No, it's in the little day-to-day decisions that are being made and the planning and the execution of that minute by minute, day by day, extremely well planned out, creating the product that you see walking the halls or as you walk into the classroom and you're like, magic is happening here. But it happens because of the little things that are being done well. The second part of explicit instruction is that it's relentless. Moving from public school into classical Christian school, if you've made that move before, I think one of the temptations to fall under is that, good, now I don't have to work with all of these students that took up all of my time. I'll just work with these, you know, on grade level or above grade level, really ambitious, gifted, talented students, that finally I'll be able to do that. Well, reality sinks in when you have these 18 third graders looking at you and you've got, you know, some good students and you've got some, and then you got Billy playing with the paperclip still. And you realize that you just have plain old kids again. They're everywhere. And you have to deal with the kids that are strugglers and kids that are naive. How do you get them to where you want them to go? And the reality is, by research, some of those kids need 10 to 30 times more practice than your regular kids. Well, how are you going to do that? 10 to 30 times more practice time? And I don't think as a teacher you can be okay with just leaving those kids behind just because it's a lot more work. And the temptation is, well, I'm a classical Christian education. We have high standards. It's rigorous. And if you don't fall in line, well, sorry, you're just going to be roadkill. I don't think that we can do that. I think our target is 100% of our kids, and 100% of our paying customers are expecting this. So this is part of our job, as hard as it is to accept and swallow. The third thing is it's engaging. And we'll talk about strategies of how to maximize practice time I have some solutions. It's engaging. And this is where we'll kind of settle in a little bit. So we have this big goal. We want these lively discussions with our kids. But it doesn't happen because we want it to happen. We're building the house. We're building a foundation on the little day-to-day stuff that eventually when we get there, we can have all this wonderful discussion. We can have all this magical time. But it doesn't happen by chance. And that's the right target to shoot for, because the truth, with this quote I have, truth lies in the communication. So when we're having this conversation, when we're having this communication, that's when truth is coming out. So we want to develop a system and a classroom where we can have communication, because truth is what we want to shape our kids. But it has to be in the form of communication. It just can't be just sitting there in people's heads. So the more chances you have to talk, the more chances you have to encounter truth. And we want truth to shape our students. But not all students are geared that way. They're not all just pining to communicate in your class. So you have to prime the pump for those reluctant and those naive learners. I have a sports background, and one of the more important things to do when you learn a sport is to learn the rules of the game. I went to college in Illinois, and many of the friends of mine were really into hockey. I had never really played hockey except for just out on our frozen pond, but like actual, organized hockey by rules other than just knock people over. I didn't understand offsides. I didn't understand the role of the blue line. I didn't understand all of that. And so when I'm playing, I'm not going 100% because I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing. Am I offsides? Am I onside? Do I go for the puck? Or, I'm unsure because I don't know the rules of the game. So translate that to a classroom of naive or young or new learners. If they don't know the game of what's going on, if I can use kind of that crude term, if they don't know the game of how this happens in your classroom, because your language is inconsistent, they're not sure if it's time to raise your hand or not, and if you haven't been consistent with how you're going to do your instructional routines and your procedures, kids don't know the game, and so your naive learners are going to be reluctant to play the game. And if they're reluctant to play the game, they're not going to talk. And if they're not communicating and talking, then they're not really actively engaged in what you want, which is ultimately them to be shaped by truth. They have to be involved in it, but they also, in order to do that, you have to set the terms and the rules of the game. And so they walk into their classroom, they know how to play the game, and so they'll participate. This was going to be a slide about Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and apparently you have to buy the internet here. But if you remember in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Ben Stein is an actor. He is the Bueller. But one of the scenes is him as an economics teacher teaching the economic policy during the U.S. during the Depression. And if you remember that scene, no one's paying attention. And his famous line is, anyone? Anyone? Think about that scene and think about all the things that are going wrong as a teacher in that scene. Well, first you have one person is doing all the talking. Who is that? The teacher. The only one talking. The teacher is answering his own questions. So he's asking questions, but he's answering his own questions. There's absolutely no wait time other than anyone, anyone. There's no with itness because there are people sleeping or drool bombing their desks. There's no with itness. There's no scanning around. And there's no checks for understanding at all. It's just plowing through the materials. So when we talk about good instruction, we have to first talk about four delivery elements that are important. Four things as a teacher have to be there. So this is how we start setting the rules of the game. When you're in the classroom, these things have to be in place so kids know how to play. The first one is you create a focus. So whenever you are giving directions or giving instructions, they're done in the focus position. So when I'm standing here in this place and I'm asking for your attention, I'm asking for it in the focus position. I often see teachers that will have kids doing wonderful things. They're in partners, they're in groups, or even working by themselves. And the teacher immediately starts into instruction but hasn't stopped the previous activity and allowed kids to disengage with that and then re-engage with you as a teacher because they haven't created a focus. And they start talking over the kids, and of course, not everyone's getting the information, and the teacher gets frustrated because kids are talking when the teacher's talking, but you haven't given them a clear focal point. And you also have to think about, where do you want that focus to be? Is it on me? Or are we reading a book? Is the focus focal point on the book? Or if we're up on the board, where's that focus supposed to be? But you have to tell the kids, this is where I want your eyes. And the eyes are really the thing that you have that tell you what kids are focused on. So you say, class, eyes on me. You're creating a focus position. Class, eyes on your book. Class, eyes right here. That's the focus where you want. And now kids know, oh, I better pay attention. Something's going to happen. I'm going to get instructions. I'm going to get information. The second thing is you provide wait time. After you give a question, you must provide an ample amount of wait time. And this is very basic, but often we forget about it. The importance of wait time is not for Sally who knows it all. The important wait time is for the reluctant learners, for Billy, to grasp what's going on, to think about it, and be engaged in the learning, and be able to participate in it. If you never give kids wait time, then that's when you start running them over, and they start spruining all out, you know, they're roadkill, they're just all over. You know, you provide the wait time to get everyone with you and moving together with you. The third thing is you have to utilize clear signals, and we'll talk about this more. Signaling is critical for grammar because you give a very clear start and a clean finish in what task you want them to do. Again, when you start muddying things together and you want multiple things going on, you're using multiple strategies. First it's me, now it's partner groups, now back to me, now we're doing this, now we're doing that. You need to have those clear starts and clean finishes to know what's going on, because you'll start losing kids. And signaling is the way that you do that. The last one is include a verification, and we'll talk more about that later. But verification is how you affirm correct answers and also give an additional practice for kids. We talked about you've got kids that you need 10 to 30 times more practices. How do you do that? Well, a verification is the way to do that. And again, we'll talk more about that. The goal is active participation. Everyone needs to be actively participating in their own learning, because the ones that are doing the thinking are the ones that are doing the learning. But the thing you have to be careful of is the compliance versus engagement. You may have kids staring at you with their eyeballs, complying to your to sitting up in a, you know, sitting in a learner's position, but they're not engaged in anything that's going on in the class, because you're not requiring of them to be actively participating in it. You're just expecting them just to comply and not cause a problem. So how do you know if kids are engaged in what you want them to learn? Well, you have to make it visible. There are three ways you can make it visible. They need to say it, they need to do it, or they need to write it. Because you can't crawl inside a kid's head, nor maybe do you want to, and find out what's going on in there. They have to make it visible for you to be able to understand if they're being engaged or not. So they have to say it, write it, or do it. The loop for effective teacher delivery is this. We've been active participation. So when you are doing your whole group instruction, it should be about 85% of it should be group responses, and only 15% of it should be individual turns. If you want kids to be actively engaged in what you're doing and actively participating, then you need to get everyone involved as much and as often as you can. Think about your own practice. Think about how often you are relying on individual turns versus choral or group responses. Many of the classrooms that, you know, of teachers that I've been into, both public and even at classical Christian schools, rely a lot on hand raising and individual turns. Your goal is 100% mastery. But you have to be able to get there and know if kids are learning it through monitoring and feedback. And the best way to monitor and feedback that is through positive reinforcement. again, we're priming the pump, and the water runs smoother when you're positive about things, from a 5-to-1 ratio that you are. And some of it is retraining yourself as a teacher, that if you are looking for 5 good things to every 1 corrective behavior, then you yourself will retrain yourself to look for the good things that are going on in your class and not the negative things. And as a class, as the atmosphere of your class, the enrollment of your class will become more and more positive because you are being more and more positive. And kids will like that more. They'll be engaged in that more. They'll understand that this is the way we play the game here in this class, and I want to be a part of that. I want to participate. So let's talk a little bit deeper about student engagement. There are 3 parts of it. The first one is frequent responses are elicited. 3 ways to do it. We've talked about this already. Verbally, written, or action. Say it, write it, or do it. So let's talk a little bit. We're going to spend most of our time talking about the verbal part of it. And these are something that's very common in classical Christian education. It's wonderful that you have a rich pedagogical history of core responses. That's not been always the case, at least in public school. That was something that had to train teachers with extensively on how to do this. But as you think about your own practice, of these 3 things, verbal, written, or action, which one do you do the least? And which one would you like to increase as far as improving and adding this to your repertoire of what you do is to get active participation from your students? So let's talk about the verbal core responses. So let's do an experiment. You get to be my class. What day of the week is it? Thursday. So let's try it again. And I want you to notice the difference between the 2 ways I asked that question. Everyone, on my signal, when I drop my hand, tell me what day of the week it is. Everyone? What was the difference? One was a better quality response than the other one. What was the difference? Wait time. What else? Clear expectations. What's that? Starting time. Clear signal. Focus. Yeah, I was in a focused position. I discriminated. I said everyone. That includes my 2 sons in the back that are not paying attention right now. Yeah. Is it Wednesday or Thursday? So you can see even the small little tweaks can turn the question and answer into a much better product of higher quality response. So the things that have to be a part of it is you have to cue it. I use a signal of a hand drop. The cues that work the best are apps. A snap, a clap, tap. Those are the best cues because they have sound, and kids respond to that better. I said a hand drop works if the focus position is on me, but if you have kids reading and their eyes are on their book, they aren't going to see the hand drop. So you need to have something that has noise to it. It is also crisp. So when I want a response, I want a crisp response. I tell people we want to be crisp like bacon because nobody wants to eat soggy bacon. So the response has to be crisp. And last, it has to be choral or together. The mistakes that happen is if they're not choral together, if they're not crisp, then you end up getting the robotic kind of answers that go like this, or the long, elongated response, the drone. You should expect kids to say it like they would speak it. So they have to be crisp, timely responses, and don't accept robotic or drone elongated responses. When you get into your Shirley grammar, and they're doing this, is expect the crisp core responses. And if they're not, it's an error, and you will correct that. This core response is not aping, but it's part of the imitation and part of what we've talked about previously of just good, basic, classic pedagogy. The other thing you have to watch for is the coattailing or the parroting. The responses have to be together. So again, little Billy, who's not paying attention, all of a sudden hears Thursday, and he just jumps in at the, you know, coattails it, you know. He's not actively participating. You can hear that, the echo. And lastly, teachers should not be the ones answering their own questions. So if I said what day of the week it is, and I say Thursday, who do I hear? Me, right? I don't hear if I'm getting a strong, solid response from my whole class. So I say nothing. I'm listening. And that will help me hear if I've got the coattailers, the parroting, or if it's a weak response, like that first one. Like, is it Thursday? A challenge I'd like to present to you is to not rely on hand raising. Any answer that's short and the same, turn it into a core response. And don't use an individual turn with it. So if I say, what day of the week is it, Ezra? Everyone else is off the hook. Only Ezra's the one sweating. But it's the short, it's the same, and I threw it out to everyone, and everyone had an opportunity to participate, and my expectation is, if I was a teacher, that everyone will participate in this. If it is long and different, that's when you can do the individual turns. But there's even a way to do individual turns to keep kids on the hook as long as possible. And you do that by waiting to discriminate who gets this one. So if I say individual turns, what day of the week is it? Everyone's still on the hook. I could call anyone at this time, and eventually I'll call a name. So my goal is to keep everyone on the hook as long as I possibly can. And then if you notice on the slide, there's a verification. The verification is affirming that, yes, it's Thursday. And I could even add it. I could add at the very end another opportunity of repetition of today is Thursday. These additional verifications, add those repetitions that you're looking for those students that need the extra practice. So it affirms the correct answer, and it adds additional practices in a very quick, efficient way. The second thing with engagement is student performances are carefully monitored. So as a review, 85% of your time should be in core responses when you're doing whole group instruction, with only about 15% of it being individual turns, for the purpose of keeping everyone actively participating. If you rely on hand raising, then I know as a student that's a reluctant student that I can just chill out. I'll just never raise my hand and I don't have to worry about a thing. But if you don't rely on hand-raising, and most of the time I'm going to be asking core responses, I've got to get with the program. And that's going to prime the prompt for me. The expectation is when you're in Mr. Lockyer's class, you're going to be participating, you're going to be talking, and that's what I want, because I want them to feel good about being verbal and vocal in my class, because I want to have these lively discussions at some point when it's developmentally appropriate. So I have to build up to that point. John Hattie wrote a book called Visible Learning, and he talks about that engagement, student engagement, or really the most powerful way of modifying and enhancing that is through feedback. And those of you that like cooking know the idea of dollops. Like when you get a pie and you want whipped cream on there, you don't want a little whipped cream, you want a dollop of it, right? You want the big glob on it. And that's what you have to be doing as a teacher. Dollops of feedback. Kids need to know, yes, you're right. Yes, that's right. Good job. I like how your eyes are on me. Just boom, just dollops of it. And that will, again, that will prime the pump, and that will get the water flowing, and that will get kids going where you want them to go, and they're not just chilling out back there. We've heard the adage of, you know, which dog gets stronger? Well, the one that you feed. If you're constantly feeding the positive dog, then that gets stronger. That becomes just part of the aroma of your classroom. Let's talk about specific things that you can do as far as instructional routines that enhance your classroom practice. The first one is fluency repetitions. But let's first define what fluency is. It's not just reading fast. It's three P's and an E. So it's not just the pace, but it's kids' awareness of punctuation. It's kids' phrasing, or be able to group words together. Good readers phrase, even though there may not be punctuation there. They don't just read a long sentence and just... They phrase it together to make it more appealing to the listener. And they will do it naturally, but not everyone has that natural instinct. So you have to teach kids how to phrase. And then their expression. When there's dialogue, you do something different with your voice. When there's different characters interacting, your voice does, when they're scared, when there's expression in that. All of those things involve fluency. And it, like I said, it's just not about reading fast. But part of fluency, there's a way that we can improve fluency, get a number of practices in place, and do it in a really efficient amount of time. So we see this commonly like with reading programs. We have a list of words and single words, vocabulary words, that we want kids to practice being able to read and read fluently. Well, how do we do that? How do we get a lot of practices in a short amount of time and kids will be able to master it? Because that's our goal, 100% mastery of 100% of our kids. Well, we call them, these we call fluency repetitions, or the fast, faster, fastest way. So as you have a list of words, you follow the script. First word, what word? I signal it, yes, and I affirm that, I verify it. Next word, what word? Yes, and we go through it. The second time through, we start stripping away some of the structure. We strip away the verification. Back to the top of the column, beginning of the row, faster way. First word, what word? Next, next, next. And then we do it again. Fastest way, top down, bottom up, on my signal, go. And they've gone through the list three times in a very efficient way. We have gotten a ton of practice, a ton of repetition, and it's a way for kids to really master the content. So let me show you that in practice. This is our second grade doing a reading group.
Fast way. First word, what word?
Fluttering.
Yes, fluttering. Okay, now when we say our words, we want to say it crisp.
Before we do that, I want you to make a T-chart on a piece of paper. Make a T-chart. On one side, I want you to write the word correct for correct responses. On the other side, I want you to write incorrect. So make a T-chart. One side's correct. The other side's incorrect. Every time you hear a correct response, you're going to put a tally mark. So you have a T-chart. One side's correct. One side's incorrect. So every time you hear a correct response from a correct student response, put a tally mark. Every time that you hear an incorrect student response, make a tally mark. If it's corrected by the teacher, make a plus sign with it. So correct responses, tally, tally, tally. If it's incorrect, put a tally over here. If the teacher corrects it, put a horizontal line through there and make it a plus sign. Got it? All right, we'll start over. Let's try that again.
Fast way. First word, what word?
Fluttering.
Yes, fluttering. Okay, now when we say our words, we want to say it crisp. Fluttering. Okay, we don't want to stretch it out. Fluttering. Back to first word. Everybody's pointing. First word, what word?
Fluttering.
Yes, fluttering. Next word, what word?
Bellowed.
Yes, bellowed. Next word, what word?
Mumbled.
Yes, mumbled. Next word, what word?
Rubbery.
That word is rubbery. What is the word?
Rubbery.
Yes, rubbery. The word is rubbery. Let's go back to the top. Ready? First word, what word?
Fluttering.
Yes, fluttering. Next word, what word?
Mellow.
Yes, bellow. Next word, what word?
Mumble.
Yes, mumble. Next word, what word?
Rubbery.
Yes, rubbery. Next word, what word?
Bobbing.
Yes, bobbing. Next word, what word?
Inflate.
Yes, inflate. Next word, what word?
Inflatable.
Inflatable. Good job. Now we're going to go back to the top. This is faster. Everybody's pointing to the first word under B1. Ready? Faster way. First word, what word?
Fluttering.
Next.
Bellow.
Next.
Mumble.
Next.
Rubbery.
Next.
Bobbing.
Next.
Inflate.
Next.
Inflatable.
Very good. Now this is the fastest way. We're going to read down the column and then back up. B1, pointing to the first word on my signal. Get ready?
Fluttering. Bellow. Mumble. Rubbery. Bobbing. Inflate. Inflatable. Inflatable. Inflate. Bobbing. Rubbery. Mumble. Bellow. Fluttering.
Good job.
All right. How many correct responses did you get? Shout out. Anyone? Did anyone do this? In the 30s, right? Low 30s? Did anyone get around? Yeah. Maybe upper 20s, low 30s. There was at least one incorrect response. Did you get more than one? One? Was it corrected? Yes. And we'll talk about the error correction. But the error correction that she used that we'll talk about is my turn, that word is your turn, everyone, what word, starting over. It's model lead test and then retest. We'll talk about that more later. But so in a short amount of time, we got 30 repetitions with kids. So that was about just over a minute. And we've talked about this before. If we're going to have kids master it, some kids need 10 to 30 times more practice. Now, for the kids that got it, was that beneficial? Yeah. They may not have not needed 30, so that's why we needed to keep things moving. But for the kids that did need it, they got it. And it didn't take me a whole lot of time to do that. So this is a great way of single word fluency to get lots of practice in a short amount of time and to get through things for the purpose of 100% mastery of 100% of my kids and not just the kids that get it first time through. A lot of times you'll see a word list, you'll go through the word list, and then you move on. And some kids just don't get it. They need extra practice. Here's a way to do it, the fastest way. Another format to use is probably one that's maybe more familiar, is read, spell, read. So this is a fourth grade class with doing spelling list. Again, you can make use your T-chart, just draw a line and add. So correct student responses, incorrect students' responses. If it's corrected by the teacher, add the plus sign to it. So the read, spell, read is we read it together, we spell it, and then we read it again. And then I'll talk more about how you can even enhance that to get even more practices out of it.
You are new spelling list. Number one, terrorism.
Terrorism. T-E-R-R-O-R-I-S-M, terrorism.
Number two, alliance.
Alliance. A-L-L-I-A-N-C-E, alliance.
Good, I like how I'm seeing some of you track with your finger. Number three, atomic.
Atomic. A-T-O-M-I-C, atomic.
Number four, concentration.
Concentration. C-O-N-C-E-N-T-R-A-T-I-O-N, concentration.
So how many correct student responses did you get in that one? Yeah, it was just a partial list. So you have kids reading it. You have kids spelling it, so they're different, using a different modality. And they're reading it again. You can add, so you have read, spell, read. You can add write, spell, read, so they can write it. So first word, what word? Atomic. Spell atomic. Write atomic. Check atomic, and we check it. And read it. So you can add even more layers to what even was on there in the demonstration when you add a writing part of it to allow even an additional way to practice it and even additional form. So you have kids, you know, reading it, spelling it, writing it. You saw in both of those situations we had tracking. We called it two-finger tracking. So one of the more difficult things is, so it's whole group instruction. I can get a lot of core responses. I can add individual turns in there to kind of keep the things moving. But eventually we're going to have to do choral reads, and only one person at a time is going to read. And when that happens, then the rest of my class is just going to, what, check out, right? There's nothing visible I can do to know if they're reading or following along or not. I'm looking around, I'm trying to motor around, but, you know, as soon as they see I'm gone, like, you know. So how do I make it visible to see if kids are engaged in core reading, even though if they aren't actually the one reading? Well, we do two-finger tracking. The way we two-finger track is this. So I'll turn around. So my left finger keeps track of what line I'm on, and my right finger keeps track of what word I'm reading. So if you've had kids that read and they skip whole lines and they just keep going, like, hello, like, that doesn't make any sense. Well, this finger helps keep track of, this is the line I'm on, first line, second line. It just moves right along the margin. My other hand, my right hand, is what smoothly tracks under the words that I'm reading. And even if I'm not reading it, it smoothly tracks under the words that someone else is reading. So I can look, I can scan with my teacher eye. I can scan and see if you're, okay. And I'm like, Billy's like, Billy, let's go. So I can see visibly if they're involved in this reading or not by the two-finger tracking. Mistakes that are commonly made is kids will bounce their finger and they read like this. No, it's smooth. It's smooth and steady. And then when they get, and here's part of the fluency, when they get to punctuation, a comma, they tap once. So I get to a comma, I tap once. The purpose of that is for me to attend the punctuation. And you've seen kids blow through end punctuation, blow through commas, you know, they're just driving through the intersection, they see a stop sign, but no, they're just going to keep on going through. Now, the way that we teach them how to attend to punctuation is with two-finger tracking. When I come to a comma, I tap once. And it's not, bam. I just lift my finger and just touch the paper. But it forces me to stop. And then when I get to end punctuation, I tap twice. It helps remind me that I have to wait just a little bit longer. That stop sign there, I need to wait. And that's what good readers do. They attend to punctuation, and this is a way to train them. The other thing that's nice about the two-finger tracking is it helps train, especially young readers, trains and disciplines their eyes to move left to right, top to bottom. Many of your students come in, they've been doing video games, and stuff is like this, and their eyes are like, and then you tell them to, like, discipline your eyes and move like not happening. And a lot of the reading problems happen because kids' eyes are not disciplined to go left to right, top to bottom. The tracking helps them, helps train their eyes to move from left to right, top to bottom. So two-finger tracking is something that we do. It makes learning visible. As a teacher, I can scan and see if you're with me or not. It helps trains and disciplines their eyes, and it also helps them attend to the punctuation and be more fluent readers. I would two-finger track that, but I don't want to stand on the grand piano. But you get the ideas. As you're reading along, you've got one finger moving down the margin. My other finger is sliding smoothly under where I'm reading. And when I get to commas, I single tap, I double tap in punctuation. And I can see if everyone's with me or not. Another strategy is with questioning. Essential parts of questioning are not, I mean, the question is really important and you're preparing for that, but there are steps that go along with that to make your question more effective as far as the quality response to it. The first part is that I get their attention. I'm in a focused position. So whatever you're engaged with, you disengage with that, you attend to me. My discrimination is this for everyone or is it individual turns? And again, I'm telling you what I want. These are the rules of the game. Everyone, what is the Cyclops in the Odyssey? I'm telling you what I want. I want everyone to answer this question. That wasn't a good question. Everyone, what is the name of the one-eyed giant that Odysseus meets on the island? Everyone, who is it? The Cyclops, right. So everyone knows they're on the hook. Now, that's short and sane. My next question might be, how did Odysseus beat the Cyclops, or how did Odysseus get away from the Cyclops? Well, that's any number of answers. That's going to be long and different. That's an individual turn. But again, I'm waiting to the very last minute to say who's going to do it. So, individual turn. How did Odysseus escape from the Cyclops? Everyone's still on the hook, right? No. And if I knew the names of my classmates, which I don't know everyone's name in this, but I could call on someone. But everyone has to at least think about the question, because Mr. Lockyer might call on me. So I wait to the very last minute to say the name of an individual turn. And then last thing is my signal, and then verification. Yes, it's the Cyclops. The Cyclops is the giant on the island. And those two additional verifications give you two extra practice. I affirm the right answer, and I give you another practice, and you hear it again, the correct answer, and it helps get those additional pieces, those additional practices I'm looking for. So here's what I'm talking about. Your comprehension questions, here's the script that you would follow with that. Again, these are the rules of the game that you're trying to give to the kids. The consistent language, they know what's going on. When you say everyone, when you say individual turns, they know the game. They know what's going on, and they will participate and they'll play it because they understand the rules of it. It's important, again, for your focus position. So as your two-finger tracking, we're reading the Odyssey, and I would say pause, finger freeze. The reason for that is this. If I don't say that, what happens to their hands? They lose their place. And after we go through the question, we're like, okay, let's pick up where we started. And like, where? Are we on page 12? Finger freeze. What's the name of the one-eyed giant on the... Everyone, what's the name of the one-eyed giant on the island? Everyone, what is it? The Cyclops. All right, continue. And everyone's there. If I don't say finger freeze, eyes on me, so I want their fingers frozen, but I want their eyes. I want your fingers frozen, but I want your eyes here, because I have a question to ask you. So those simple little things make all the difference as far as the quality of responses and the engagement and the participation of your students. If I don't do those things, if I say, what's the name of the one-eyed giant? I get one hand raised, I call on that student, and then we keep reading, and Billy's made a bazooka out of his paperclip because he doesn't know what's going on. So I'm holding it all together. Everyone's moving with me because I have these instruction routines in place. We'll touch briefly on vocabulary instruction. Academic vocabulary is essential. But you can't just assume that kids are just going to catch vocabulary. You have to be intentional and deliberate with that and have specific instructional routines. Most of you are reading literature that's a year to 2 years above your grade level. So if you're second grade, you're reading fourth grade reading material. There's a lot of high-level vocabulary for kids. So you've scanned the chapter ahead. You've pulled out essential vocabulary that you're going to teach. You can use that single word fluency, fast, faster, fastest, to pre-teach that. So when kids see it, they'll be able to read it fluently. They won't have to guess, especially if they're multisyllabic. You want to really make sure they've got it. And so from there, we can even go further with it with vocabulary instruction. And this is where we can start kind of layering things on together. So this is explicit instruction. I'm not going to have them guess. These are vocabulary words that are unfamiliar but yet important. They might be multisyllabic, so they're difficult. So I'm going to pronounce it for them. I'm going to tell them what the word is. I will give them a student-friendly definition. That's the explanation, but it's student-friendly. And that depends on what grade level. So for sixth graders, I might be able to pull it straight from the dictionary. But first graders, I'm going to have to modify it to make it student-friendly. Then I give examples, and I also give non-examples, what it's not. And again, these are additional practices that your brain's hooking onto these things examples, non-examples, it helps them retain the information. I elaborate, and here's where I can add parts of speech. I can add prefixes and suffixes in a word family. I can even pull in Latin for, like, if it has a Latin derivative. So I can start layering grammar. I can layer Latin all into this vocabulary instruction. And then, obviously, I check for understanding. So let's do a quick little trial run of it. So this is a math lesson. I've pulled out the word transversal. It's an important word, but it may be unfamiliar. So it's something we're going to have to pre-teach. I tell them, this word is transversal. What word? Transversal, right? And so now I've got a student-friendly definition. It's a line that intersects two or more other lines. Everyone, what is a transversal? Yes, it's a line that intersects two or more other lines. Now I'm going to pause and punch. I'm going to emphasize important words to, again, help kind of the brain to hook onto these things. So a transversal is a line that intersects two or more points, or two or more other lines. So the phrasing, even how I say it, helps the brain attend to important words. I pause and punch important words. And then I give examples and non-examples. And again, if I could stand on the piano, I would point to one. I would say, is this an example of a transversal? Yes or no. Is this an example of a transversal? Yes or no. And these are all cool responses. You're with me. We're going. My check for understanding is the same thing. I'd point to this, and I maybe want to check in on someone. Individual turn. Is this a transversal? Xavier, yes or no. And I can start checking in. If he looked a little glassy-eyed, a little deer in the headlights, let's check in on him, see if he's with me. Let's zoom ahead here. All of this is in a cycle and is in a circle. I've created clear learning goals of critical content. My goal is for all my students, 100% mastery, 100% of students, and 100% accuracy. So let's talk about what happens when they're not accurate. And accuracy, inaccurate or wrong answers are not something that get in the way. It's just part of teaching and learning, and they're opportunities to reteach. So what do you do when you have a student make a mistake? You have errors. You need the same thing. You need to have a systematic, consistent way to correct that errors. It can't be, oh, come on. The roll of the eyes, like we just spent 5 minutes talking about that. Come on. As a teacher, how I correct errors is really important in communicating truth to my students. I want a classroom where it's okay to try, to fail, to risk, and to fail miserably. It's great. It's part of learning. But I have to model that through an error correction procedure that encourages mistakes, but doesn't let them get by with them either. I want 100% accuracy. So not even the approximation of, you know, yeah, you're kind of there, just going to slide into there. No, I don't want approximate. I want 100% accurate. So it's the model lead test retest. So we're reading along and someone makes a mistake. It's finger freeze, pause, eyes on me. My turn, that word is. Your turn, everyone, what word? And starting over. The reason why I want them to start over is the retest. It's very easy to correct the word and then move forward, but I never know if they've actually got it or not. So I have to have them back up, try again, but I need two things. I need some time between that and some junk, so to speak, between that for them to experience the word again, and when they see it again, I'll know, did the correction stick or did it not, and I have to give another correction and we'll try it again. So on my single word fluency, they make a mistake, and I think that was modeled by my second grade teacher. She corrected the mistake. I think it was inflatable. My turn, that word's inflatable. Everyone, what word? Inflatable. Starting over. And they started the column again. They had word, 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 word. We're getting to inflatable. Did they get it? Yes, they got it. So that time and junk was important for the retest. When you're in the story and you're reading the story, Similar thing. I would add a finger freeze. My turn. That word is. Signal. Yes. Starting over at the beginning of the sentence. Again, it's so easy to be like, that word is, and then they keep going. Your goal is 100% accuracy, and you have to have the retest for them to see, to have them tell you if they've got it or not. So you start over at the beginning of the sentence. And if this is just what you do and it's normal and even neutral effect, you're like, well, this might, you know, the kids might be like, but if this is just what you do and you're very, you know, nonchalant about it, very matter of fact, it just, everyone makes mistakes. And we just start over. And you got it, and you can affirm that and give some positive feedback with it. But again, if you're rolling your eyes, sighing, like, that word is, starting over, then everyone will start getting that same attitude. But if it's just the way it is, that word is, starting over, everyone does it, no big deal. But what happens when you have, you're teaching something, and how do you know, how can you review that? We do something called the goodbye list. The first time you encounter a word, if it's incorrect, you write it down in a sticky note or on the whiteboard, and you write that word down. And this happens more commonly like in a reading lesson. It's the first time they've experienced the word. They made an error. You've corrected it, but you want to know later if they've got that word. So on a goodbye list, you write that word down. And then the next lesson, you start off with a goodbye list as a review. If they get it correct, you put a check mark. Three checks in a row, you say goodbye to it, and you put the line through it. If there's an error, you put a slash mark, and they have to do three in a row after that. The goodbye list is a great way to review sounds, words, and you can see even on their comprehension questions that the first time you've asked it, they got it incorrect. And they have to do it three times in a row to get it firm. Particularly early readers, you want to make sure that they've got this stuff down. And you can see on here, like, they have the CH sound that was incorrect. The OU sound, that was incorrect. There were some comprehension questions that were incorrect. Here's a way to review that three times in a row, and you know, yep, they got it. These are essential, critical things that you have pulled out as a teacher that kids must know. Here's a way to review it. All of this is very important to keep the pacing going. I've given you a lot of formats, a lot of routines, but if they're not done crisply with a strong pace, your lessons can drag out and can really get long in the pacing, and then you lose students in the engagement. So there's a delicate balance you have to make between using these routines, using them effectively, knowing when to use them, because if you use too much of them or do it for every word, you can't do these formats for every word. These are only ones you've selected that are critical. If you do it for every word, you're going to be there forever, and your pacing of your lesson drags, and you'll lose kids. So there's a tension there. Your pacing has to be perky and has to be moving along. The last thing is successful. The success of your students, as you as a teacher, is your success is based on how well they learn. The attitude of I taught it, they just didn't learn it, doesn't fly. Teaching and learning happens together. So the last thing I'd like to leave you with is I'll leave you with my contact information. But I want to leave you with this quote. And this kind of goes along with the theme that we've been talking about, is that we are building up warriors for conflict. And so we need to have them learn the rules of engagement, and it starts with you in the classroom, of actively involving them in the truth that you are giving them and shaping and forming their lives. And the little things that you do make a world of difference. My name is Travis Lockyer. If you want to email me, it's my first letter, my first name, so tlockyer@aca-cc.org. If you'd like to email me with any questions or comments, I'd appreciate that. Thank you, everyone, for attending. Have a great conference.